It's a new year, 2025, and you're probably thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How can I make this the best year ever? How am I going to build something for myself? I'm dying to be my own boss or see if I can turn this business idea I've been kicking around into a reality. But I don't know how to make that happen. Shopify is the key, and let me tell you how. The best time to start your new business is right now. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates. No coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. Shopify makes it easy to manage your growing business. They help with details like shipping, taxes, and payments from one single dashboard, allowing you to focus on the important stuff, like growing your business. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Established in 2025. Has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle to start selling with Shopify today. shopify.com/redcircle.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Decade Project at One Heat Minute Productions Patreon. And you may be hearing this on the main feed, so welcome. My name is Blake Howard. This show casts its eye back a decade from the position in time that we are now recording in 2024, back to 2014, to look at the movies that are still hanging around or should be most relevantly for this specific film. I almost feel like, and I'm going to get into it with my guest, that this movie instantaneously as it came out with every person that I knew who saw it, loved it, and yet it was almost instantly underground as it was released, despite the fact that it had at that time an Academy Award winning actress in it. It had a whole stellar, incredible cast, and it was Oscar Isaac star rising. It was JC Chandor flexing, and yet 2014's a most violent year is still to this day deeply underrated. Now, I understand the assignment as a podcast host and booker of guests. So I need to get a guest who is adequately suited to resurrecting this bad boy. They have just put Lyle Lyle Crocodile in the top 250 on Letterboxd.
We did it.
We did it. We did it, gang. Managing editor of Letterboxd, my friend. More importantly, my friend, Mitchell Beaupre. Mitch, so good to see you. Welcome to New York City in the 1970s. Welcome to Oscar Isaac's most clinically delivered Al Pacino impression.
Yeah.
Tell me why in the list of 2014 movies you were so intent on coming back and talking about A Most Violent Year.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for having me back. Very excited to be here. And yeah, when you were talking about doing the Decade Project again, like you did last year, doing it for 2014 movies, I think the first, like, I quote tweeted it with a gif, the gif of Jessica Chastain doing the, this was very disrespectful move from this movie. And it is because exactly like you were saying, like there are great movies from 2014. You know, I love Interstellar as much as anybody. I love Whiplash. I love, you know, Edge of Tomorrow, I think, is one that collectively we've all sort of like, we, you and me were there day one, you know, championing it when it came out. But I think even as a culture, like, it's kind of risen very clearly in the ranks, especially in like Tom Cruise's sort of filmography and everything over the last 10 years, where it's basically established like that movie's a masterpiece. Like, everybody loves it. You did the great Brightwall Dark Room episode on that too. And like, but I think A Most Violent Year, yeah, it's like this movie that it came out, it got a really sneaky release, like A24 in the US at least dropped it. Like, I think it came out like December 31st, 2014 in like two theaters in the US to like qualify for awards that like it barely got any, right? I think Chastain got like a Golden Globe nomination, didn't get like any Oscar nominations or anything like that. And then it came out in like actual theaters and like I saw it in theaters in February of 2015. Yeah. And it was just this like period. It was early in A24's run to like, it was like their second year. So they weren't like A24, like what they are now. And I think the release, it just got really quietly put out there. It got like respectable reviews. There were people like, you know, you and me, like I, you know, it was in my top five of the year when it came out. But yeah, even to this day, I think it's one that people don't really talk about that much. And I think it absolutely deserves to be talked about, like in that upper echelon of what I think is a very good, like a very strong year for movies overall. Like, this is a kind of a banger year, as you're talking about, you know, throughout the course of this entire year. A lot of good movies came out, but I think this is one of the best ones.
I understand you and your men have a job to do here, but we're in the middle of a 10-year-old's birthday party.
And I'm sorry, but we are coming in.
That's not a problem. We have nothing to hide from you. My husband is a good man. Don't mistake his honesty for weakness. He deserves respect. This was very disrespectful.
I run a fair and clean business, and I will fight till my last breath to prove that.
These are dangerous times and we have to adapt. It's not like when we was driving.
There were more murders and rapes in this city last year than there have ever been. So if you've come to tell me that we have an urgent security issue here, trust me, I'm aware.
This can't continue. You're at war here.
It's been 2 years since you started investigating my industry. Do you have any idea who's been doing this to us?
Or you may be doing something to bring this on yourself.
I have always taken the path that is most right. The result is never in question for me. Just what path do you take to get there?
Where did you get that?
Your youngest daughter found in the bushes outside her front door. It's not a brick through a car window. This is your kid playing with a loaded gun. Katie!
The DA's coming down with a 14-count indictment. We've just pushed it a little too far, that's all.
Can't have this situation continuing.
If one of these guys shoots someone, it will be the end of everything that we have worked for.
You now have serious legal cases against you, ranging from fraud to tax evasion.
It wasn't your good luck helping you out all these years, it was me.
I don't want anything to do with this!
When it feels scary to jump, that is exactly when you jump. Otherwise, you end up staying in the same place your whole life. And that I can't do.
It's also so, like, I think you definitely understand, I see it in your work quite a bit, which is there's a lot of filmmakers who are aspiring for 70s, what we would say, vibes,
yeah,
and feelings. And some filmmakers, and I think it was also like quite dismissive or like some certain critical voices were like a link to one thing. Oh, it's the aesthetic makes it the thing. And oh, the actors and the kind of ensemble is the thing. But there is something so incredible about the pace of a most violent year that actually is the thing. It's like if you are an obsessive of New Hollywood in the 1970s, which I am, none of these movies start fast. Yeah. Everything, I mean, even the biggest movie of the 1970s, it still has, early 1970s. I just want to qualify that because 1975, you also have Jaws, and then in 77, you have Star Wars. So there are those films. But the early 70s with The Godfather, the movie starts at a wedding.
Yeah.
And
for like
an
hour.
It takes so long, and you're so pleased to be watching old relatives sing badly and slur their words because they've had too much wine out of a flagon. All those things. The pace of A Most Violent Year. It was one of those things that when I was watching the writer-director, J.C. Chandler, this is one of the first things I'd ever seen him do. It was one of those things where you were very passive in your cinema seat, and then you lean in and you're like, what is he doing? What is he captured here? And it is just the tempo of the conversations, the patience with not a massive running time. It's not like 4-hour movie. It's the patience, but there is something just so like Bob Rafelson about the pace of this movie. It's just taking its time to just do and paint the picture of what the city is. And there are dramatic moments and of height and time, but like just everything seems to just creep. And I can't get enough of that pacing. And it's, I mean, we also have to quickly talk about, it's like before we get into the cast and all the particulars, the one thing that I would say in the Decade Project this year, as it's gotten bigger, more films to talk about, and will go on as I continue to do the Decade Project, is like, okay, what's that filmmaker doing? A Most Violent Year and Kraven the Hunter could not be two wildly different swings in someone's overall body of work that are coming out 10 years later to be like, everyone who thought J.C. Chandler was going to be Sidney Lumet's successor is now like, Kraven the Hunter? What? Is this movie even coming out? Like, is this the fake movie inside of The Fall Guy? Like, what is this?
Yeah, it's such a drag. Like, Chandor, like, immediately kind of burst onto the scene with Margin Call in 2011. Yeah. Like, so many people were like, who the hell is this dude? Like, that movie has, speaking of pace, like, that movie is so sharp. Like, that has such, like, a quick rhythm. Then he goes and does All Is Lost, his follow-up in 2013 with Redford, like almost like the like antithesis of Margin Call. Like he really scales it back. It's just Robert Redford on a goddamn boat for, you know, nearly 2 hours. It's like so minimalistic, barely any dialogue. Then he does this, and then after this is Triple Frontier, which is like a little bit more, you know, amped up. But even still, like Triple Frontier, I rewatched it recently for the first time since it came out. And there is like a real patience to that one too. It is very like character driven in a way that you wouldn't expect. There's some like very adrenaline fueled set pieces in there. But overall, I think it is a movie that taps into like this core idea of like these men and kind of what they've lost and what they're trying to gain back and like what those dynamics are with each other. And so like, he's a really interesting director in a sense that I think if you look at all four of those on the surface, he looks more like a workman kind of director, which is not a disparaging comment at all. You and I, you know, we love like our workman directors, our directors for hire. But I think that there really is like a consistency in how he approaches his movies. There is like a no nonsense kind of attitude. He talks about how he always wants like story to rule the day. And I think in something like A Most Violent Year, it takes a lot of confidence for a director to come in with exactly what you're talking about, that kind of pace to kind of table set, to really build the audience into what's going on, like what the environment is of this city that these characters are in, what the costuming means for each character, what each of these dynamics are as we're slowly kind of ramping up the tension of the plot. But it really is like, it's a fascinating movie where the plot, if you try to explain it just like on its face to somebody, it's really complex. Like it's really knotty, but with the way that that pace is like so delicately drawn out, I don't think you ever like get a sense of not knowing where you're at in the story or like what this character means to this character. Like it all develops very like organically. And then you get to some of these moments in the end or set pieces in the middle where like you're just stunned by how much adrenaline there is there, how intense it gets so quickly. But that intensity is developed because it's being drawn out slowly and slowly and slowly. You can feel it simmering within Oscar Isaac's character, Abel, within Jessica Chastain's character, Anna. Like as it's going on, that tension is just there lurking underneath the way that it does in so many of us, like in our day-to-day lives. Like we just kind of, you know, take all of that stuff in and we hold on to it. And then one day shit just snaps and you're like, where did that even come from? You know, like I didn't even realize I had been feeling that for 2 months before now, but damn, it feels good to get it out. And I think this is a movie that does exactly that. Like it builds it, it builds it, built it, it releases it, and then it pulls it back and builds it again, and then releases it again, you know?
There's such a beautiful way that you describe the waves of this movie, because I love that Abel, Oscar Isaac's character, he's absolutely phenomenal in this movie. I mean, he's already a phenomenal, like it goes without saying that Oscar Isaac is great. Let's just get that out there. But man alive, he in this movie as Abel, the wave that you're describing is so related to his control of the situation, him fitting into the narrative that he's built for himself, him articulating the narrative that he's built for his life, and JC Chandler lets him deliberately go on with that. And Jessica Chastain, I find as a performer, my favorite Chastain performances is when she is mean. I don't know what it is. I'm sorry to lovely, sweet, fun Jessica Chastain performances, but something like this where you slowly see the levels of control that Anna has, underhanded control has on her lives, and is sort of working behind the scenes with a wonderful Albert Brooks as their lawyer. And you're watching her and his desperation and everything he's willing to sacrifice and do, and then her to play hands to cards like that he didn't know that they had, and how that what he's willing to sacrifice for his morality, and the way that she is sort of dictating terms, like I'm not just fitting into your narrative, I'm now taking control. Man, those performances have an electricity. Those two together have an immense chemistry, but those waves of realization, control, trying to fit something into your narrative or remit things, and how all the supporting characters interplay with that. I love the revelations in this. And when I watched it recently in preparation to talk to you, I found myself just being pleasantly surprised again and again with all the ways that Abel is doing all these noble things to dig himself out of holes. Yeah. And how Jessica Chastain continues to, as Anna continues to like, go and hide these boxes under the house. And you're like, oh God, what has she got in there? You know, like everything that happens as she's been sort of squirreling away money and doing sorts of things, it's just like, oh, okay, this is that. Fair enough. Understood.
Yeah. Yeah. The marriage at the center of it has so many different kind of layers to it. That's so fun to unpack. And you can see them like, these two went to Juilliard together, like they go back way back, and this was like their first time working together in a movie. You can see them really digging into it, and I think having that history with each other helps with them giving each other exactly what they need in scenes. And I think that like Abel is like, he's such like a fascinating character, because he talks about how like he has a line like, I spent my entire life like trying not to be a gangster, and it's like, bro, you married a gangster's daughter. Like you knew exactly what you were doing. And so like he comes in, like he has this like air of like respectability to him. And Oscar Isaac is so brilliant at like portraying this. He walks into a room and he commands it, but not in a way where he's trying to like puff out of his chest and be demanding. He just has a real poise to him. He's like very composed. He he comes off very much as like this guy who believes that what you give out to other people, the respect that you give out to other people, is like what you're looking for back from them. And he charms everybody around him, even the people who maybe don't respect him because they see him trying to be like straight laced in a world where you can't really be straight laced. And he has the sensibility of like being an immigrant looking for the American dream and trying to do it like the quote unquote right way. He talks a lot about, you know, doing things right, doing things the most right way, which is a very compelling way of saying I'll bend the rules that I need to do in order to do it the most right way. But he won't get his hands too dirty. And there's like, at first you think that there's like a nobility to that, but the more that it goes on, it's almost like it's a willful ignorance, because he knows like who he's married to, and he knows that there's like something going on there. There's scenes where she'll kind of tease, acknowledge that like maybe she cooked the books on something, and he's kind of like, well, don't tell me about that. Like, I don't need to know about that, you know? And it's like, you're kind of getting the benefits of her being the one to get her hands dirty while still wanting to put off your own airs of like, I'm not getting dirty. And that's a really interesting thing to unpack with both of them, because she's then taking on all of that weight herself of like being the one who actually has to like do the shit and like let him think that his hands are clean. And I just love her character. I struggle a lot in general with like Chastain. I'm kind of like hit or miss on in general, but the performances, I think she's like a little bit too calculated of an actress. And so the performances that I think work really well for me with her are the ones where the character is very calculated. So I love her in this. I love her in Zero Dark Thirty and like Molly's Game, like where you intentionally want to see the character, like those gears turning in her head constantly. And that's exactly what she's doing here. I love what you said about loving the performances of hers where she gets to be mean, because she just like soaks that shit up. And like, there's such a great dynamic with the two of them where like she's basically just cucking him like the entire movie. And like, she is the boss and he knows it and she knows it. And like, there's definitely like clashes there. The scene with the deer is like the exact, you know, the apex of that, where they hit the deer. She tells him that he has to, you know, the deer's still alive, you have to put it out of its misery. He gets out with a tire iron, is like hesitating next to it. She comes up behind him, just blasts the shit out of it with a pistol, and is like, it's done, get back in the car. Like, oof.
And buddy. he's like, where'd you get that gun? It's like, again, that air of like, his life is the story that he's told himself about his life. And so much of it is true, but like, it is about a, you know, in stories, unlike life, it's about calculating a mission, right? Where you go, I don't need to go down that rabbit hole because that's going to take me somewhere else. I don't know. I want to stay focused. And so this focus story of his life is there. And she's doing all the things that are in the dark in this story over and over again, as you said. And it's so funny how big his blind spot is, because even as you're hiding boxes underneath a house, he's like, oh, we're surely not squirreling away money. I've got to go and beg and borrow and negotiate with Alessandro Nivola's character about partnerships and this and that, and understanding that, oh, it is Nivola that's trying to, you know, wheel and deal to get me out, or it is this character that's trying to keep me at a certain level. And he seems so wily and smart with the intricacies of power dynamics in his industry that he's worked his way up, and which is why it's put him in the position that he is. And yet at home, he's just so almost dunderheaded by the end of the movie. You're like, how did you not see it? You see every angle, you see every minutia, every move that other people are making. And yet at home, it's nothing. And that's what makes it exciting. It's not an infuriating movie. I say this to say, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen the movie in a long time and you are thinking that I'm saying in any way that it's an infuriating thing, no, it's a delight. It's a delight to watch how Abel is so distant from that. And he's even telling the story of his life back to her a couple of moments in the film. And she's like, don't tell me this bullshit. Like, don't tell me bullshit that you sell to your new salesman. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
This is what it is. You know, I squirrel away money. I do some things. And even Albert Brooks, bless him. Great run for Albert Brooks too in this late, you know, let's get him in to do
drive and concussion and stuff like that. Like, he's just like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to act again. And I'm going to act in a way I've never acted before. That story about him doing, like, convincing Refn to let him do drive, where he, like, pins Refn up. Like, Refn's like, you can't, you don't have, you know, the grit, like, the villainy to do this. And Brooks, like, as he tells it, grabs Refn by the throat, slammed him up against the wall, and said, I could kill you right now if I wanted to. So good.
If only we could have seen into the letterboxed offices, because I hear that's how Mitchell was managing editor.
That's how it happened. I said it needs to happen. It's going to happen however it needs to happen. And, you know, Abel should have said that himself a lot earlier. I do, yeah, like the fact that, like, he can kind of wheel and deal and charm, like, he can read everybody. Yes. He can charm everybody except for his wife, because his wife is the one person who can read him like a book, you know. Yes. And knows exactly the shit that he's selling. And I love it. Like, it's such a smart dynamic. I think a lot of people, you know, understandably compared this to something like The Godfather, because, like, even just aesthetically, that's clearly what Chandor's going for. Something really, like, if some of the reviews I was looking back at them, like, knocked it as, like, an imitation of, you know, Coppola or, like, Lumet. I feel like it's more in the spirit of them. Yes. More than an imitation. Like, it doesn't feel like a facade of that stuff. But I think that while Abel, clearly, in the sense of, like, an immigrant trying to do things the right way, not like somebody who's in the sphere of organized crime but not wanting to get his hands dirty, like, that's, there's clearly a comparison there with him and Michael Corleone. But you know, Diane Keaton in The Godfather is not what Chastain's doing here. And I feel like that's a very important distinction that sets off, like, what makes this its own unique thing is that relationship right at the core of it, and how that kind of everything revolves around that.
It's actually, you know, it's, you talk about Lumet, you talk about Coppola. It could just as easily be like a Scarface-ish story, a story of an immigrant. Sure. Who's making their way in a big American city, you know, trying to get what they perceive to be is their own slice of the American dream. But one of my favorite conversations ever in any movie is, you know, Michael, you know, senators don't just kill people. who's being naive now? Okay. You know, like, it's that's the one of the great conversations also. And that's, in fact, if you're talking about the interplay between those two characters in the sense of A Most Violent Year, it's Abel that's it's being naive. Anna is being Michael. Like, who's being naive? Like, of course I squirrel away money. Of course I skim some off the top just so we have an exit strategy. Of course I cook the books, because everyone's cooking the books. And how do you think we get ahead? How do you think we live this life? How do you think we live like royalty in New York City and have this huge home and have this security for our family and have the money to pay for lawyers and have the money to negotiate these huge gigantic deals that are going to be tipping points in power for our family, for the industry, against the forces that don't want new entrants, against the forces that have done the wheeling and dealing politically. And you can sort of see the beginnings of and the sort of, you know, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship sort of moments that are in the film with David Oyelowo. So it's really, you know, it's got all of those ingredients, and it's got so much to sink your teeth into. And it's, and yet Chandler does those incredible sequences, the hijacking sequences, and then Abel following hijackers and trucks and trying to hunt them down himself, and watching how that all unfolds and how it plays out and how he starts to figure out the ins and outs of who's doing what. It has such a great deal of satisfaction and unpredictability, which is so hard to do. And yeah, it's quite special. It's so interesting. Margin Call, great movie too. Yeah, must strongly recommend that. Of course, All Is Lost, so incredible. Triple Frontier, great, great, great. It's more interested in Ben Affleck being a terrible real estate agent in many ways than it is in the action. It needs to establish those things, and I think this movie's pace, there's so much to establish it. Take you off kilter, watch Abel flail for so long, and then when he finally embraces I guess, that he does have to get his hands dirty, the movie goes to another level and it becomes much more exciting, and you can relish it at a whole new level.
Yeah, God, that the sequence that you were talking about where he, so like the people, Christopher Abbott and Matthew Mayer, are like hijacking his company's oil trucks and stealing them to sell them to the other oil companies. And there's the whole sequence where Abel chases down them in one of the trucks that they're stealing, and it becomes this like riveting car chase that then turns into a foot chase, and Abel catches him, like starts pistol whipping him, and like sees like in that moment, like this is what he's going to have to do in order to kind of prevail. He has to get his hands dirty. Like there's no way around it. That whole sequence is such a good like crystallization of this character and his like his drive and his resistance. But when everything's up against the wall, like he knows what has to happen. And like, it's almost an instinctual thing of he has to just turn it on and not look back. And even in that moment, I want to talk a little bit about Bradford Young, the cinematographer in this movie, because he is, I mean, I think he's one of like our great cinematographers. He's crushing it. That scene, there's a shot in the foot chase where it's like tracking, like Oscar Isaac is running towards the camera.
Yes.
And the camera's like pulling back away as he's running towards us. And Oscar Isaac, he like trips and falls. And for like 2 seconds, the camera keeps going. Like it almost makes it look like, I don't know if it was, if he accidentally fell or not, but like, it looks like he falls and then he, you know, the camera keeps going and then stops and like pushes back towards him. I just love that move in general. But over the course of the movie, like, there's such like a painterly way to how Bradford Young shoots this movie. What he does with light is so great. It's all done in the winter, so there's like snow gleaming off the ground. That's really well done. But in general, the way he frames people, like everybody is really, there's like so much distance between the people and the frame. And I think that it captures this air of like loneliness that all of these characters are facing, how everybody's kind of like on their own doing their own thing. And it establishes this great sort of synergy between the like intimate small scale details of the characters, because the story is like so intimate, but at the same time it's really painting on this like more macro scope of what's going on in the city at the time. The fact that it's called the most violent year, 1981 was like on record the most violent year in terms of crime in New York City, and what it means for the environment, where we have this really like distinct class divide in this movie. We're focusing on all of these wealthy people who are trying to gain more wealth, but the city around them is completely crumbling. Like there's graffiti all over, you know, all the walls. Like you can see like abandoned areas that they're driving through because so many people were fleeing New York because of the crime at this time, but it doesn't really affect the upper class because they're profiting off of this crime. And so I think that like every detail of the movie is tapping into like what's going on around all these characters, but all in these really subtle ways where it's not, you know, putting this hammer on, this is about the class divide, but it like, it is, you know?
Yes. And it's, you're so right that painterly and then frenetic and balancing those two things in the same palette. It's like, well, one of these things is not like the other. It's not going to work like this, but it's like, it has such a sense of space and it has a sense of, the whole city is a fixer-upper, like in many senses, because you see these, sometimes it's these beautiful mansions and things like that, but it's still cold. It's not like well-worn. There's no, like there's not years and decades of a family living there. So you see these people who've suddenly burst into the next strata of society. So they're sort of there, but it's still cold and it's not there. And then you go back down to these spaces where they work and they live. And that's the stuff where it's like, there's 40 years of people working in these factories. These trucks look old as hell. Like these yards look old as hell. Like the buildings look like they've been there for such a long time and they've just sort of stood the test of time, because it's kind of like all in that previous part of the century. It's all sort of like built up. And it's on that precipice, which is like now, you know, as an outsider to New York City, I go and visit a couple of times and it's like this big, beautiful thing. Anything that's old is getting knocked down, rebuilt, refreshed. It's, you know, there's still parts of the city that very much retain the kind of late 70s, 60s you know, 50s sort of architecture, those sorts of things. And then there's parts of the city that are just blooming into these, like, well, we're going to have this multi-billion dollar project that's going to build this new building that's going to just clear it out. So it's this whole gentrification piece, which it's on the precipice of. And so having that all together and connect is so great. I hadn't clocked, let's just quickly go to Bradford Young's resume just for a quick second.
Yeah.
Like, it's a, I mean, wow. In as many years, Selma, A Most Violent Year, Arrival, my word, incredible, like, couple of big, big movies all around at that time, and then lots of shorts and film clips and things like that. Yeah, yes, Solo. Which does look great. It does look great.
It does look good. Yeah. I mean, he did Ain't Them Body Saints, the David Lowery movie before Most Violent Year. Like, there was a couple years there. And this could also be an opportunity to talk about Oscar Isaac's career, because I feel like Oscar Isaac too, like, is Oscar Isaac. So there was a moment, you've done an episode already on Ex Machina. There was a moment when Ex Machina came out and I was like, Oscar Isaac, Alicia Vikander, Donald Gleason, like, these are, like, this is it. This is the next generation of actors. Like, 2015, you know, 2014, 2015, like, the three of them were all just, like, delivering. I was so excited about their careers. And you look at their careers now and it's like, what are their agents doing? Like, what's going on in, like, Hollywood? And I feel like it's more just a symptom of, like, the movies that are getting made these days, you know, like, there's really not a ton. But, like, Oscar Isaac, like, he does Drive, he does Inside Llewyn Davis, he does Ex Machina, he does this, and it's like every single time this dude is delivering. And now then
that
he just, like, goes
enough of a resume. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, standard in Drive. He's great, antagonistic. It's a lot of flash. It's a lot of show. He's pushing the boundaries against Gosling, sort of glacially slow, deliberate, intentionally stripped back. You've then, you know, even before then, you've got him in Shay Part One. He's in Body of Lies. He's in Robin Hood. He's in Balibo. He's crushing across the board. And then he gets Inside Llewyn Davis, which we did last year on the Decade Project, which just feels like a movie that is so, and particularly with, you know, physical media like Criterion, which we're such a huge fan of, it's like that has now been either both established and reestablished as, like, that is a classic. That is a stone cold classic. Followed up very quickly, as you said, by Ex Machina and A Most Violent Year. It's like, can this guy literally do everything? And this is the symptom of the kind of industry that we're in now. It's like, oh, then he gets a Star Wars.
And then he gets X-Men.
An X-Men, and you're like, oh, okay. Okay.
And it's just like life itself and the promise and like, it's such a drag. And so then he does do the Card Counter, which Paul Schrader, my favorite director of all time. I love the Card Counter. I
love
Oscar
Isaac.
Card
Counter. Oh my God.
But even like just doing something like, I mean, I know people love the Dune movies. I'm not really, you know, big on it, but it's like he's fine. Like, he's good in Dune 1, and like, his voice performance in Spider-Verse is solid, but it's like, where is the next and most violent year? You know what I mean? Like, it just feels like we're getting these actors. Donald Gleason is the perfect example, because he'd had like Anna Karenina, he had Ex Machina, he was great in The Revenant, you know, and Brooklyn, he's fantastic in too. And that was all in like 1 year. He had like four movies and he was fantastic in all of them. And then it's like, now he's the lead in the reboot revival of The Office or whatever. And it's like, that was one of our most exciting actors. And it's just such a drag that like, people just can't, there's no room for that to happen. You would say, you know, thinking of this as like a movie that feels in the spirit of the 70s, right? Like, actors like James Caan, actors like Elliot Gould, they had room to like maneuver and
Bob
like
Hoskins,
become
like,
something. Hoskins,
Bob,
yeah.
Bob Hoskins, I mean, although in some of his big, he does take the wildest and weirdest swing with like Super Mario, but like, there's that whole late British period Hoskins stuff before he breaks big in Hollywood, where there's just
Mona Lisa.
Oh my God. Long goodbye. There's just there's so many back to back to back to back that he's absolutely incredible. And it's now you kind of see Oscar Isaac becoming a commodity and people, you know, getting him for voices, whether it's Adam's Families and or going and doing the Moon Knight and things like that. And it's just like, right now, I would give anything to see him shave his head and dance with an android. You know, that's all I want. I want him back. I want that Oscar Isaac back. And the card counter was a lovely detour. It was like, it's almost like you see him do this and you're like, this is the resume performance. This is the one where he's like, okay, back on my list of Ex Machina's and A Most Violent Years and Drives, the card counter is going to live in that world. It's outside.
Yeah.
He's distancing himself from one to the other. And it's like, I think that metric of success where actors can go and do it, it's much the same I feel about like Chris Hemsworth. For so long, he's been occupied doing Marvel movies. And I kind of like his batty Australian charm in like action movies. I'm like, he's more of like a Schwarzenegger successor. I like him hitting people with car doors in Extraction much more than I like him in a Thor movie. Like, I don't know what it is. I don't know who to tell. I'm just like, please can more of that, because I feel that's where his real strength lies. And it's really interesting how he's done that. And I don't have an answer, but it's like, you know, as we sit here on the precipice of Michael Mann making Heat 2, it's just, I keep feeling like if he's not cast as the Pacino character, I don't know who could be. I'm like, he's been waiting there for such a long time. Like, give this guy the shot. He's ready.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, it, you know, get him in there, put him up there against like him. Adam Driver, Austin Butler, like, come on. Like, that's a movie. That's a movie right there.
That's,
like,
guys, that's a movie. And directed by Michael Mann with any actor is like, that's a movie. Let's just go. Yeah. Can we make these things? Can we do that?
Yeah, and I think a big part of the problem is, like, J.C. Chandor is doing fucking Kraven the Hunter now. Like, you know, the people that actually have that vision are so quickly, like, wrapped up into this. And it's like, J.C. Chandor, like, he hasn't had a movie. Triple Frontier came out 5 years ago. Yeah. Like, he's surely been trying to get stuff off the ground, and it's just like there's no market for these kind of movies. And I, you know, actors just get kind of lost in not knowing where to go. Like, you still want to act, you know. I'm sure there are reasons that are exciting beyond just money for doing, you know, Moon Knight or whatever. I don't really know, but like, I just wish there was more card counters out there. I wish, like, even, you know, his next thing is he's doing the Guillermo del Toro Frankenstein movie. And it's like, that's great, Guillermo del Toro, but it's still like a Frankenstein movie. Like, I just,
it's so funny. I'm going to share a theory. I think I've mentioned it before, but I want to share it with you because I feel like we're on the same page with it. Is the thing that I get so frustrated with in these, and I will never get frustrated with people sorting out their lives and getting a big role and getting a big paycheck for their family. It's like, we're going to buy houses. I'm going to set up, you know, in the United States, I'm going to set up college funds. Like, they don't have what we've got here in Australia, where you can still go to university if you get great grades and like have a deferred payment system. And our universities aren't as expensive. So it's like, it's not a crippling debt for life to have a university degree. Like, it's still definitely very expensive, but it's more manageable. I'll never begrudge them for that. However, when these franchises, and it's even the same thing with Barry Jenkins, who I absolutely adore, it's like when they get into the machine of one of these big studios where they've got to make something, whether it was Ava DuVernay going to Warner Brothers, whether it's Barry Jenkins, I feel like they get the most exciting filmmakers and they put them on, like in sports in America, they call it like injury reserve. Like, they're out of the game.
Yeah.
They're still in the game. They're still a filmmaker, but for like 4 years they get taken by Disney. And I'm like, I get making stories on the biggest scale possible and as a motivation to challenge yourself to see if you can still connect with audiences through all of those impediments of like the biggest storytelling possible. However, I'm like, could we not have just given Barry Jenkins 10 times $10 million to go make 10 movies? Yeah. And even if only 6 of them were fantastic and made 10 times their money back, we would have 10 more movies that Barry Jenkins made, rather than he's been out of the game, like makes Underground Railroad, which is incredible, but then he's out of the game for years making a Lion King movie. And it's like, we only have so many precious minutes, hours, days on this planet, and yet he's stuck doing that. And that I and it's also like the, you know, you mentioned Guillermo del Toro, like a guy who whose career for the longest time was so frustratingly typified by like development hell, literal hell, where things, so many things had simmered to like basically pre-production and then get abandoned. I just look at this and I'm like, Oscar Isaac is the guy that I don't want him stuck in a Star Wars. I don't want him stuck in an X-Men. I don't want him stuck in a Marvel movie. I want him to go off and do something and then immediately abandon it to come back to this. And hopefully those big Star Wars movies have basically set him for life so that he has the flexibility to go and just choose whatever he wants from this point out. So yeah, it's a really fascinating and interesting, it's really fascinating and interesting sort of like landscape now that you're observing in this 10 years. That's what I'm starting to really see crystallize in the 2014 movies. It's like there's still a big capacity in 2014 to make smaller movies, really great movies that will cut through, really great movies that will resonate and make money, but they're at a smaller scale and you can relish it. You know, two movies this year being a most violent year in Ex Machina, Oscar Isaac bangers, two in the same year. And 10 years later, it's harder to spot the clusters of fantastic films in his resume.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point too. Like, and it's, in looking back a decade, right? Like it's, you think that surely things can't be too different, but you look back and it does feel like a completely different kind of landscape. I, like you talking there, I was thinking about like Jeremy Saulnier, right? Yeah. Like comes out of the gate, like, you know, Murder Party was what it was, but like Blue Ruin, like Green Room, like Hold the Dark, like all bangers. And now, like after Hold the Dark, like he gets stuck in this like debacle of production on True Detective. So like he had to like, first of all, just go to TV, like period, which yes. So many are doing these days. Like so many of our great directors, Carl Franklin, you know, doing just TV these days because they can't get movies funded. And then Rebel Ridge for Saulnier has been taking forever to get out because, you know, it's been such a like a troubled production and everything. And it's like these guys who, like even somebody like him who isn't selling out to do a Marvel thing or whatever to get the paycheck, which like you said, like, you know, if he does, like, I, you know, fully respect it or whatever for like the reasons that you got to do it. But like he's trying to get his stuff made. He's trying to do Rebel Ridge. And it's been like, when did Hold the Dark come out? 2018? Like, it's been like 6 years since we've had a Jeremy Saulnier movie, when back at that time we had, you know, three absolute stone cold stunners in like 6 years. And it just feels like a totally different world now. You did a recent one on The Rover, right, for the Decade Project last year. Like that's a movie that like I just like, where does that get made these days, especially with Guy Pearce and with Robert Pattinson and with David Michaud? You know, like it's
David Michaud is the big one for me in Australia. I just go, yeah, such a great storyteller. They had a great storytelling collective at Blue Tongue Films in Oz. There were so many cool shorts and films that all came out. You know, my best friend Maria Lewis calls it Yeah Noir, which is Aussie neo-noir, and which I love to pieces. That's a Letterboxd list I've got to get her to curate for sure, because it's so good. But I'm like, why do I have to watch David Michaud make these American films or these like period films on that scale? It's like, dude, come back home. Like, make 25 movies here. Like, just make them. And the love of Animal Kingdom and The Rover should be enough to just go make 10 movies. And obviously then you go and he makes these other things. And I just feel like that outsider voice, although he's a really establishing good filmmaker, it's like, no, there's something very specific about the Australian voice that you have a command of. And that's what the audiences both locally and internationally want. And so, yeah, it's really strange how you see, like, it's almost like the tragedy of it is there. And after having spoken to Jeremy, I know that Rebel Ridge is very, very close to having to seeing the light of day, which I think we can all be thrilled and excited about. So that's very cool. However, yeah, it's like I'm heartened to think about him. Like, I want to see him then just take on some other cool crime adaption. I want to see him tackle, you know, the next big thing and move into it and collaborate with an author or a writer. It's you know, It's there's so many good, great crime novels and novelists that, you know, you and I are both familiar with. I'm like, oh man, I would have loved to see Jeremy Saulnier have a take on my dear friend Jordan Harper's, you know,
I was about to say, let's get some Jordan Harper adaptations going.
Some Jordan Harper adaptations, some S.A. Cosby adaptations. I'm like, man, alive. Can you imagine directed by, you know, based on the novel by S.A. Cosby? It's got Jeremy Saulnier directing. Do you think you and I wouldn't be at the front row dressed up like kids going to see Star Wars in 99 at the theater? Yeah. You know, like it would be crazy. But I think that that's actually the sad thing about this, our most violent year, is that like after those three, All Is Lost, Margin Call, and A Most Violent Year, and then Triple Frontier, that was a huge movie on Netflix. Huge.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, is that like he gets that made, but it has to, like, it just goes to Netflix, right? And yes. So it's like, it's that's such a different, like, that's sort of seeing where the years are going there, and then the next thing he can do is, you know, goddamn Kraven the Hunter. And it's like it's, you see the drip of it, right? Like Margin Call, like it, you know, was barely really, I can't even remember who had like Relativity or like some, like a very small company yes. had it here in the US. And then like All Is Lost, and this too, like this A24 had it, but it was like such like a nascent A24, you know, yes. they did like, it, this was like pre-Moonlight A24. So like
this is pre people wearing the A24 hats.
Yeah.
And the constant, like it's so funny that like, the film company that people have made their personality, like it's yeah. And I say that with love and adoration. It's like, yeah, like back in the day, if you saw a Fox Searchlight, sometimes you'd be like, oh, this is going to be a good Fox Searchlight.
Focus features was like, man. My personality for, you know, the better part of 10 years, probably.
Paramount Vantage. Yeah. Shout out
Warner
to
Independent. Like, come on. We had a time, something going for a while.
We were eating, guys. 10 years ago.
But yeah, like this was still the era of like half of A24's movies went to straight to like direct TV. And like, that was the only way that you could like watch them because they had that deal with them. And so like, it wasn't what it is now. So like the struggle of somebody like Chandor to get his movies out there, even back then, like imagining what a guy like that would have to do to get anything made these days, like with his vision. And, you know, I'll be curious what Kraven the Hunter looks like. I can't imagine, you know, I will be able to see his stamp in it anywhere, but maybe in the hope, the big sky hope is that somehow it'll allow him to finance something else. But I mean, yeah, like you said, like these guys get lost, like John Watts, it's kind of like a punchline these days, but like Cop Car, because he directed all, you know, the Spider-Man, yes, Cop Car, yes, is a good movie. Like Cop Car
is like an excellent movie.
Solid, like early director movie. Kevin Bacon's fantastic in that. Like you could see a guy go from Cop Car to a Green Room. Like Cop Car feels very in the spirit of like Blue Ruin. Like you could see a guy like that, like amp up just a little bit to like this next level, but they bring him right into Spider-Man, and then he's just lost in that
and then he's Spider-Man, and then he's like, okay, I've made three gigantic movies where I've been stuck in a studio for X amount of years, I'm kind of done. And then that fandom and the industry are like, oh, so stupid, why would he leave? It's like, guys, he's made like his films have just made something like $3 billion. Leave him alone. Like, let him go make 20 million, 30, like go give him 8 million so he can go make something, or go give him 15 million and he can go make something. It's like, that's the trade-off.
Yeah.
And when you make a movie for 20 million, or you can go and do something for, you know, 30 million or something like that, and it can make any amount of money at the theater and then have a Netflix deal or a Prime deal or something like that, the money's coming back to all of its investors if it's a good quality film. And if you're lucky, you strike an incredible deal, or you strike like a Moonlight, you make Moonlight and it costs $4 million to make, and it makes $100 million at the box office. Like they exist. And I just think if I was from an investment strategy perspective, I would much rather be dealing with 10 filmmakers getting $40 million each to go and give me a crack at making my $400 million back, rather than just purely from like a really clinical, like as an getting older person going, like if I was investing the money, I'd rather 10 shots with 10 really wildly different filmmakers over a number of years than investing $400 million in one. I can't see that. Maybe that's like, you know, that whole thing, like you got to spend money to make money, blah, blah. I'm just like, I don't see it. I don't see how that works ever. It always ends in someone getting fired and all this overwrought creative control. It's just like, why do Blumhouse exist? They exist because they play that game.
Yeah. Like Blumhouse is like on the total opposite end of it, where he's like developed such a smart strategy of, you know, putting $1 million into something that makes, you know, 30. And that's a huge return on, you know, investment. But even somebody like thinking about somebody like M. Night Shyamalan, right? Like he you know, went into like Oblivion because they were throwing so much money at him to make After Earth and, you know, Avatar, The Last Airbender and like whatever. And the only way he could come back was to self-fund The Visit and Split, like put up, you know, $20 million of his own money. And those movies did huge numbers. And now he's doing Trap, which is exactly the kind of movie that we're talking about that just doesn't exist anymore, where like he was able to just do that himself. And like, why are we not getting, you know, 10 people do it? We don't get 10 movies like that, period, you know, throughout the year. It's either the one thing, the big superhero movies, or it's, you know, Kevin Costner putting 4 homes up for, you know, mortgage to be able to make his own movie because nobody else is going to let him do it unless he just does it. Or it's the, you know, Paranormal Activity, you know, 23 or whatever.
Yeah. And it's, I don't get the thing it's also funny because there's a clip of Kevin Costner and people like, you know, you're a really wealthy man. You've made a lot of money. Like, why, you know, when we're trying to connect with you as a person who self-funds a $20 million movie because you want to make it, you know, how do we connect with you? And he's like, because I believe in it.
Yeah.
He's like, I believe in it. I want to make them like, and he's like, and I think it's a really good idea. It's really special to me. And so I would rather fund a $20 million movie out of my own pocket because the studios don't want to play, or new investors to the market don't want to play because the studios don't want to touch it, because I feel like it's good and I'll make it and I'll live and die by my sword. And I'm like, that's cool as shit. And also the other thing I don't understand is like that Yellowstone show, which I've not watched a frame of.
Me either.
It's so huge. Yeah. Mitchell. It's insane. Like water cooler test at work or on the train or at a family barbecue or with friends. It's like, that's like dad show, like peak dad show. Like, do you watch Yellowstone? I'm like, no. I'm like, absolutely not. Yes. Yeah. I'm like, yes. Yesterday I watched Zatoichi, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like that's more my speed. Or like I watched Holy Smoke with Harvey Keitel.
Yeah.
Like that's more my speed. I just, because there's just so many movies, I would rather not get occupied on one thing. But yeah, it's really incredible. It's really incredible that we're not seeing more of it. And I just hope that if this is the one for them, the true one for them, for JC Chandor, like,
yeah,
he can't go and make more kind of Netflix scale action-y kind of movies, how he can't do that, that, you know, that would be crazy to me. I just don't get it.
Yeah, because like in doing kind of research, watching him talking about A Most Violent Year, like you can see the passion that somebody has in something like that. Like I love thinking back to that idea, something that like watching him doing interviews for it really like clicked for me is like when reading reviews when it came out or whatever, people comparing it to The Godfather and everything like that, and like saying it more pejoratively when like it came out, which like you and I definitely don't, you know, feel that as a pejorative. But like what's really striking for me is that he talked about how the characters in this movie, like this movie takes place in 1981. The characters in this movie are living in a time where everybody is obsessed with The Godfather. So like these characters are almost putting on this front of like, they, you know, the Alessandro Nivola, like these guys, the heads of like the oil companies all meet in this restaurant and it looks like something straight out of The Godfather. And they intentionally, you know, set that up because they want to be in The Godfather. And like this idea,
The when Sopranos, he's making the movie, The Sopranos exactly. had a cultural impact on actual gangsters.
Yeah.
In like the world. It's crazy.
The fact that like when he's making this movie, he is smart enough to think that at this time, if I'm actually making this movie take place at this time, this is how these characters would behave. They would want to be in The Godfather. They would think that they are. They would think that they're that cool.
New York City is The Godfather. Like, exactly, we're in New York City. this is the Godfather time, and it's about power and even their expressions of power and what is cool and what is fashionable. And it all does kind of feel like Abel dresses like he's in the 1940s more than he dresses like he's in the 1980s.
Yeah. Chastain, but she's like good friends with like Armani. She had Armani develop like the entire wardrobe for her character because she knew that that's what her character would do.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So special.
Yeah.
Mitchell, this has been all, it is always a pleasure to talk to you about movies. As an admirer of your work, like just some of, I mean, everyone knows Letterboxd as an app, sure, which we're all obsessed with, and great reviews, and especially, you know, the some of the funniest one line and short reviews of all time, as well as really deep and thoughtful things. But you must go and check out Mitchell Beaupre's incredible resume of like a Scorsese and DiCaprio interview, Ethan Hawke, Maya Hawke. You're just building such an incredible library of amazing stuff at Letterboxd. As an admirer, I'm just so proud of you, proud to know you, proud to see you killing it. Thank you so much for doing this with me and taking your time to do it, because I know how busy you are, and just, yeah, just keep crushing it. I'll be cheering on from the sidelines as always. Thank you so much for being part of the Decade Project again, my friend.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, man. Likewise, such a huge fan of your work, huge fan of your work for a long time. So it's really, it's a pleasure to be able to come and chat with you sometimes. Always, you know, more than thrilled to find time for it.
Well, we've got some other things simmering, which I can talk to you about after we hit pause on the recording, and we'll
hell yeah.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
Having fun, got money, fun. Having fun, got money, fun.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close.
Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.